You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm going to pass over to Ben, who's going to introduce Darren. It's very complicated, this, isn't it? I'm going to pass over to Ben, who's going to introduce Darren. Here we go.
Thanks very much. Yeah, hi, my name's Ben. On behalf of Trussell Trust, my pleasure to welcome Darren McGarvey to the stage with us for the afternoon, author of Poverty Safari. Probably needs no much more introduction than that. So, at the end of the session today, some of our guys will be handing out one of our resources called Shared Journey, which is one of our Bible studies that's been put together with the aid of our lived experience partners. So be sure to grab one of those on the way out.
One other housekeeping point is this talk is being recorded. So if you ask a question, your question will be recorded. And therefore, if you don't want to be recorded for posterity, please do not ask a question. Maybe come up and ask Darren a question later. Darren.
Hello, everyone. This is very comfortable. I have a bit of a cheek to call this work. I'm just giving the signers a couple of minutes to adjust to this accent so that everything is communicated in the way that it should be. And I will do my best to use my BBC Radio 4 voice. How many of you read what this event is about? Just so I know how much of a preface. All right, okay. That's cool. I just thought you were here to get out of the rain. Which I'm sure you are. Unfortunately, to the people outside, well done for sticking about when there's so many places to get dry. I hopefully will not disappoint. About an hour ago, I did an event in the Pagoda, which was basically touching on some of the things that I have been considering ahead of writing my third book. And I've been thinking a lot about the trauma discussion that is taking place in culture, both online and offline, and civic society, politics level, and also the phenomenon of lived experience, which is increasingly prevalent in arts, media, publishing, newspapers, as well as in the third sector, where we are beginning to appreciate how important it is to include those of us with experience of particular adversities when solutions are being devised. But I've also come to a place, having been part of this culture and observed it from various proximities, that there needs to be another branch to the discussion, which has to be conducted carefully. And unfortunately, it feels like it's going to fall to me to try and do that. One, because I have the public visibility necessary to create the space for the conversation, but also because I have lived experience, then I might be granted certain privileges in such a discussion that perhaps many professionals working in various fields would not be afforded. And so there is a discussion already taking place around some of the risks of over-reliance on personal stories when devising solutions to complicated systemic problems, though many people feel understandably constricted from opening that discussion at a public level. And so I see it as partly my responsibility or job to try and create some space for that. How I would like to begin this event is I want to read to you a 1500 word essay, which is not that long for someone as verbose as me. I wrote it while I was at the Edinburgh Fringe, where I, like many other people, was doing a show about trauma. And when I was walking to the venue every day, I seen posters everywhere for shows that were happening, comedy, drama, so on and so forth. And so many of them, perhaps more than I'd ever seen, was basically the performer making the show about their own life. And I'm sure they had a great time doing it, and I'm sure the audiences had a great time seeing it. But there are risks involved when we do this as artists or people, and there are risks involved when we come to expect that kind of content from people in culture. So by reading this article, I hope to sort of open up a discussion, and then I don't think I'll labour the point too much. At the last event, lots of people wanted to come in, and so I would like to use most of the time here to take any questions or comments from you guys. Does that sound okay? Everyone can understand what I'm saying. My English is actually quite good. Renowned, you might say. Okay. So this is written from the Fringe, okay? With the Edinburgh Fringe well and truly underway, it's finished now. Countless performers are waking up rough every morning, nervously Googling their own names to trawl for that coveted 4 or 5 star review. For most, sadly, it may never appear. I've been there, and let me tell you, it's hard not to take the rejection personal, especially if your show is all about you. In recent years, there's been a sharp rise in shows that are all about the performer. Comedy, music, and drama exploring personal adversities have grown in popularity. You may think you've never heard of such a genre, but if you gorged yourself on Netflix's Baby Reindeer earlier in the year, then you are already deep into the lived experience rabbit hole. For anyone unfamiliar with the term lived experience, this is the special designation given to those of us who speak publicly about a particular type of adversity we face. From cancer to coming out, poverty to prison, and addiction to ADHD, this year's Fringe has something to offer everyone, if you enjoy that sort of thing. But many years before this brand of entertainment became a mainstay of the arts, I was one of several unwitting pioneers who road tested this highly personal brand of storytelling in the most glamorous and prestigious domain of all, Scotland's third sector. Now let's wind the clock back 2 decades. In 2001, grieving the sudden death of my mother and reeling from a family breakdown which had left me homeless and on a path to alcoholism, I carried a lot of grief and anger which required an outlet. I hastily began upcycling my trauma into my best attempt at art, and a growing interest in hip-hop and rap music quickly became a daily obsession. Notepads scrawled with lyrics and ideas, baggy trousers, hoodies and headphones, and the obligatory confrontational attitude. I began performing locally under the name Loki at open mic nights and rap battles, where I discharged my adolescent fury as autobiographical stories set to dusty boom-bap drum beats. My reputation grew in the Glasgow music scene, and I eventually established myself as a community artist. Then when the third sector got a hold of me and my story, it felt like a full-time residency some months, taking the stage at conferences where professionals sat slack-jawed and misty-eyed at my ability to not only tell my story, but to see it in a wider social and economic context. Back then, there seemed an endless thirst for my accounts of adversity, whether campaigning for Scottish independence, calling out decision makers for letting down the most vulnerable, or indeed my musical output. Everything seemed to land a little better if my opinions or observations were nested within my own experience. This eventually culminated in the publication of my 2017 debut book, Poverty Safari, part memoir, part social commentary, in which I revealed, among other things, the traumatic experiences of my childhood. And it's important just to say that when I wrote the book, I had no idea how many people would read it. And I had no idea that I would be invited on national television to talk about it. And I had no idea that despite the many, many thousands of words that I wrote about public libraries, motorway protests, community dynamics, stuff that I thought was quite dry, I had no sense this overwhelming interest would be in the few instances where I reveal neglect or abuse that occurred when I was a child. That book changed my life. Overcoming my challenging personal odds, I had been redeemed, it seemed. People loved my story, my lived experience. They loved me. In the last decade, as this type of personal disclosure has become a mainstay of civic discourse, reaching beyond the arts and into every corner of culture, charities, philanthropists, and inevitably politicians appear to see the value in hearing from those with direct experience of many of the challenges they and their organisations have a stake in addressing. But those of us sharing our experiences need to be careful. Our stories are also a commodity. They move and inspire professionals. They grace the pages of policy documents and funding applications. They may even become best-selling memoirs or, in the case of Richard Gadd, world-beating Netflix dramas. As a result, we creators may feel we are making a difference, but as our story attracts more attention, our lives themselves can become something of a performance. Those of us who trade in the currency of lived experiences are, like everyone else, unreliable narrators of our own stories. We are always rewriting them, ensuring that we remain the hero. Kernels of truth are discarded and replaced with assumption, speculation, or unconscious white lies. The truth of our lives could never be distilled into a tight three-act structure, let's be honest. Like most people, and by that I mean you, we take small liberties where certain details are concerned and massive leaps with others. As a form of entertainment, there's no real harm in this, but where lived experience is deployed in civic discourse or politics, subtly shaping policy, it is potentially highly problematic. Much like a fickle fringe audience, resident critics don't believe our stories of overcoming the odds are quite as powerful or useful as our fans and supporters do. In fact, many are irritated by the vulgar spectacle of watching people vomit their trauma up on social media or on stage. They regard lived experience as a Trojan horse that smuggles unscientific, politically motivated, narcissistic anecdotes and personal opinions into serious matters of science and politics. They balk at the notion those of us with lived experience of trauma or adversity are automatically granted victim status in public discourse because our stories are not interrogated like other forms of evidence. Ultimately, skeptics worry that every anecdote is blindly accepted as a statement of fact and fear that being seen to invalidate the lived experiences of victims and survivors too often takes precedence over the need to ground discussion and debate firmly within the realm of truth. And they may have a point. Certain stories of trauma and recovery are regarded as more useful than others, depending on one's political agenda. Take, for example, the drug debate in Scotland, where advocates of competing forms of drug treatment, such as opiate replacement therapy, which most of you will know as methadone, or the 12-step recovery method, advocates of both tend only to promote and platform those who have succeeded and rarely mention all the ones who relapsed or died trying to get well with that method. There is a cynicism at play, not just among the storytellers who develop a keen sense of which plot points to emphasise and which ones to edit out. Me talking about how my mother let me down, but me not talking about how I let my siblings down, or how I treated my ex-partners, or my current partner. And we all do that when we run off of a movie that's playing in our mind where we are the protagonist. We tell ourselves a story that we can live with. But wisely, most of you are not in the public realm using that highly edited draft of the story. Also, the organisations and institutions platforming those stories, often as a means of furthering their own social or political objectives, must consider some of the implications. And then we have the basic issue of safeguarding. What if, paradoxically, the psychological wounds we carry predispose us to enter this performative arena naively? oversharing the intimate details of our lives with little thought given to the fullness of the consequences of doing so? What if our trauma primes us for a subtle form of self-exploitation, where in pursuit of safety, security, and validation, we tell our stories in ways that actually make us more vulnerable? Our desire to help others, and yes, to gain affection and security and love, is often so overwhelming that we push aside any lingering doubt as to our fitness to engage in this risky public exhibitionism which may come to define us. And let's not forget, once we've decanted our traumas into a rowdy and unforgiving public square, we cannot undisclose them. But perhaps the biggest mistaken assumption on the part of those who feast rapaciously on our personal testimony is that we who are willing to disclose so much are representative of a mythical, voiceless mass, that everyone affected by trauma or adversity shares our experience, our pain, our story. When the truth might be that those of us who do act on this impulse to disclose and perhaps even overshare may in truth be a distinct entity, much like people who apply to go on reality TV shows. We are people pleasers. We desire validation from strangers. We feel confident in speaking our minds and wrapping our trauma in a palatable narrative ribbon for public consumption. The greatest irony of the lived experience movement is that most people living with active trauma would not be caught dead in the media. Most people with trauma don't even know they have it. And even fewer will be attending the Edinburgh Fringe this year. A trauma in and of itself. So to the many thousands of acts singing for their suppers in Scotland's glorious capital this year, offering audiences a glimpse behind the curtain of their personal lives, take it from me. Once you've told your story publicly, it's not yours anymore. And once you're done telling it, you detect a sudden dip and enthusiasm for anything else you have to say. Once you've made your own life the product, you'll be tempted to drill that reservoir forevermore. I think the public would be far more interested in the real story. The story where we confuse the fleeting catharsis of feeling seen with the painful work of actually healing. The one where we've become trapped in our own self-portraits, no longer able to discern the truth of our lives from the story we've created. The one where we naively believed our truth was the same as the actual truth. The Fringe is a great experience for sure, but take it from me, a lived experience pioneer. The next booking you need is not at the stand, it's with a qualified therapist. Thank you. Now, obviously, there's a lot in there to kind of unpack, but hopefully you guys kind of feel the spirit of what it is that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create a mood of curiosity and gentle critique while at the same time acknowledging that these discussions require care and not to be dismissive of whatever level of adversity or difficulty that someone is experiencing. And not to make assumptions about why someone might find meaning or purpose or catharsis from sharing that story. But I think in the process of the digitization of culture, where we are the product and therefore our experiences day to day are a form of capital and a commodity, we've lost touch with the idea that sharing our story is an absolutely essential part of a process of healing, but other people must be able to interact with that interpretation of our lives, and that kind of discussion can't happen in the public realm. There's a sanctity to that kind of discussion. It requires a closed mouth friend who possesses some level of insight, someone who would risk offending us by gently nudging us in the direction of truth rather than co-signing whatever assumption or story we've told ourselves. And that ultimately, when we believe that recovery from trauma is simply about telling the story of what happened, then we are removed from the reality of what trauma is, which is a wound to the nervous system that is operative regardless of the story that we tell ourselves. And in order to soothe that wound, and in order for our nervous systems to learn how to cope with triggers and cope with the realities of daily life, we need to be supported relationally to move towards areas of discomfort, rather than recede from them, rather than be protected from them. And the support there exists to offer us guidance and advice on when it's appropriate to start moving towards those dangerous things. When we try to heal from trauma or any other kind of adversity on our own, it denies the pure science of what this wound is. It's relational. It occurs in the context of relationships, with family, with partners, with institutions, and therefore self-directed individual therapy. It's a lost cause. You'll be trapped in the awareness building phase of recovery, which is when you just learn the words to describe the pain, and there you will remain in the pain. You confuse re-editing the story with progress. You confuse taking the next diagnosis off of the digital buffet. Yep, I'm type 2 ADHD. Yep, my ex is a narcissist. Yep, this is an attachment wound. Yep, yep. And you just keep feeding all of that language in to your internal monologue. What do you notice? The pain is there. The lifestyle that has grown out of the pain is there. All of the unhealthy coping strategies that you use to soothe the pain is there. All you've got is more words to describe it to yourself. So as you can see, it's a bit of a high wire thing I'm trying to pull off. Part of the reason why I'm coming out and doing public engagement while still working on the book is because I recognise it would be impossible for me to have all the answers. It would be ironic if I decided to lock myself away in isolation and think that I could come up with the solution on my own, a bit like self-directed therapy. And so that's why I have chosen to put myself around the country in different contexts with the provocations, and then inviting people to feedback on that, to comment on that. And that has been helping me to refine not just the line of inquiry, but also the tone that I hope to take, which is got to be serious, but anyone who has real trauma knows there is tremendous levity to be found. And sometimes the self-serious tone of trauma discussions at the public level is evidence of the fact those discussions aren't being facilitated by people with trauma, because if they were, they'd be a lot funnier. It's evidence of middle-class professionals who are so scared to reopen a wound that they create this kind of false sense of seriousness, that because someone's been through so much, they must be wrapped in cotton wool. We mustn't say anything that undermines their experience. When actually, most people with trauma, they have found some comedic chestnuts in there along the way, because if you don't, you will genuinely go mental. On that, I would just like to leave that part there. And then I would just like to open up to you guys. I'll thank you for sitting so nicely. Feel free to come in and I'll do my best to. My wife gave me some nice feedback. She says, look, when someone asks you a question, Darren, you've got to actually answer the question. And we've gone on our own journey of healing where that doesn't become a big argument. Certainly not here, maybe later in the car when we're going home. Okay, so I'll just open it up. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, thanks very much, Darren. As you said, open it up for questions and reflections. I think we've got someone right at the very back. If you pass the microphone back for me.
Oh, hi there. Thank you. I just wanted to say a big thanks for opening this conversation up. I think it's really important to do this. And it's more just a kind of, it's more of an anecdote that kind of confirms what you're saying. I used to work for a HIV charity and a young man was platformed at the age of 18. And it was like probably the most damaging thing for him to do that. It was so not good for him. I think he was heavily traumatized by the experience. It became something utterly toxic for him. And so what I'm trying to say is I've seen that done so badly and so profoundly damaging to a really young person who now is thriving and is really good, like 15 years later. But I think as you're saying, it can be really, really problematic. So I just wanted to thank you for opening up the conversation. And I'm dying to hear what everyone else got to say.
Thank you very much. And it's this kind of sense of comfort when I approach this with an appropriate level of anxiety and trepidation, when people who are working or have experience in various fields can recognise some of the things that I'm saying, because it helps me to feel that I'm on the right track with it. Next. Yes.
Hi. Yeah, thank you very much. There's lots of food for thought in this. I'm also working for a charity that is really big on having stories at the moment. We're collecting loads of stories. And the point you were making about how stories can be shared relationally, is there a role, do you think, for the third sector, for charities, to kind of create the space for that to happen, maybe between people who are sharing similar stories? Or is that really something that needs to happen at an individual level, separate from charity space, if that makes sense?
I think this is a great question. And I think it's always important for any organisation or institution where lived experience is an element of what's going on, to always just be thinking about safeguarding and duty of care. And that is about more than just validating the people who are involved, which is obviously very important, but it's also about saying, are you sure you want to say that like this? I've spoken to various people at different levels of kind of third sector work, including Fiona Duncan, who is the strategic advisor to an initiative in Scotland called The Promise, which was an attempt to make sense of Scotland's jigsaw puzzle care sector, which isn't really a sector. It's just a bunch of different disparate rules that apply in different local authorities and make it very difficult for people who require care. And part of how they got information about what the problems were was talking to people with lived experience. But in order to disclose that publicly, they went through a process where they devised composite stories, where they take the themes and the important information related to what the objective of that particular initiative is, and they make sure that that comes through strong while protecting the identity of the person sharing. And this was a creative way, I think, of relying less on the individual charisma or storytelling capacity. Because, I mean, some of us who tell our lived experience, we've been doing it for so long, like it's like an art form. Like, I know how to steer at home. I know what part of the story to emphasise and I know what part not to emphasise, depending on the context. And I don't mean that I'm cynical in the sense when I'm always thinking about how to make it an entertaining experience, but I go in with an objective and I know how to land that. But there are other lessons from my story that might actually be better accentuated if I was removed from the telling of the story and there was no sense that it was me. And it was focused on the issue that needs to be addressed, whatever that might be. So that's the first part. And then the second part is just when people want to talk about their story, whatever the context is, it's important that we understand that there are two parts to sharing our story. There is the part where we share it, and then there is the part where other people can feed back on what we've shared. Not historically, before therapy was a thing, before medication was a thing, this is how human beings dealt with matters of the heart. This is how human beings process trauma. This is how we sit down and talk relationally, but the conversation has to be closed. It can't be getting live tweeted. it can't be getting documented without the understanding of the people that are involved in it. I mean, there's people who have disclosed things in books. They've been in recovery meetings where people go to talk anonymously and discreetly, and then stuff has appeared in various forms of media, which is just a betrayal of trust. It's difficult because we act with good intentions, and still the consequences can be quite serious if we aren't thinking about it. Safeguarding, duty of care, all that comes first. Thanks for your question.
I work in an autism special school. This may not seem terribly closely related, but it is kind of related. I wonder how you feel about the whole thing of people finding a sense of identity through linking, particularly online, with people who have had a similar life journey to themselves and perhaps similar lived experience to themselves, but whether that is also causing some fragmentation in society, because what links us is our common humanity, and that is bigger than the diverse features that might make us different. Mm-hmm. I wonder about your comments on that.
I think you're right to bring this up, and I thank you for the kind of sensitive way that you did, because sometimes the agitation that we experience when we're confronting aspects of culture as it's fragmented online can kind of make us a bit mean-spirited about the people that are irritating us in terms of the aspects of their identity that they want to emphasise and the meaning that they make of that identity. But I think anybody who is looking externally for a solution to a pain that they're experiencing is already on kind of shaky territory. You're right that there is a common unity among all people, that we all more or less want the same things, and that we all more or less strive to meet the same needs. But there does have to be space for discussion about how certain groups are disadvantaged as a result of very specific problems that they experience. Now, if someone who's consistently been platformed, or even platformed myself as someone who's experienced poverty or someone who's experienced addiction, alcoholism, there are times when that's been appropriate for me to do that. And then there are times where I could sit here and say confidently that as a result of me perhaps getting a little bit too up my own backside about the knowledge that I have as a result of that, it causes me to make assumptions about other people because they don't wear the label as proudly. And so there's a flip side to those of us who really derive a sense of purpose from taking on a label. And I know you work in a specific field where we can get too entrenched in that identity as well. And we can become cut off from the ways that other people are experiencing things that are similar to us, but they have not leaned right in to defining themselves in such a way. One of the things, finally, I'll just say, is that neurodivergence is obviously one of the massive phenomenons just now. Not the actual phenomenon of being neurodivergent, the phenomenon of talking about it, the phenomenon of speculating as to what your status is within that spectrum, and the phenomenon of self-diagnosis in the absence of any accessible kind of clinical guidance to give us any clarity about why we think and feel a certain way, why certain things in life challenge us. And while obviously I'm not clinically qualified to speculate much about how a person chooses to go on a journey with that, what I do know is, me personally, having been labelled or diagnosed with many, many things at different points, it never gave me any further answers. There wasn't any further clarity. Society didn't suddenly reconfigure itself because someone says, yeah, you have that thing. I still had to do the work. I still had to say to myself, I live in a society where there's not a lot of sympathy for the plight of an addict. People don't even believe that it's an illness. People think I made a choice to do these ridiculous things. And so even with the label, even with that being like clinically rubber stamped, you have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. What then? You know, Still got to figure out, like, why am I procrastinating from this? What is it I'm afraid of? How is caffeine affecting my concentration? How is scribbling through my phone hours and hours on a day affecting my concentration? How does 5 hours of sleep and a bag of Haribo affect my concentration? I still have to do the work, you know? So there's just so many landmines out there for all of us, you know, but appreciate you for emphasising the things we have in common rather than things we have different.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. You've talked a little bit about the kind of different stages of trauma. Yeah. And I wonder if you have any insight when supporting people relationally, friends, like not necessarily in professional capacities, when that trauma or multitude of traumas can be so defining to an individual and become such an intrinsic part of their identity. How we help them move through or forward without trivializing some of that, but trying to support that we're more than a sum of perhaps those traumas, and whether that's an appropriate thing to do, or
I hear you.
People need to do it. Do you?
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah, I hear you. First of all, the level of trauma will be apparent in how debilitated a person is from carrying out the basic functions of their day. So, someone who is traumatized, it will become pretty obvious if it's serious trauma, very, very quickly, because when they get triggered, then basically all the what other people maybe in the spiritual field would call self, all the aspects of self, security, instincts, they all become operative. So a person will be operating from a protective, fear-based outlook while in a trauma. And then eventually they might come out of that. After they're triggered, they'll come through it in some way. Then you have other people who might be operating from a level of trauma, but there might be some other things going on in their life that's prolonging it. So for me, when I was pulverizing my mind and body with alcohol and drugs, it suited me to go and seek a mental health diagnosis at a doctor, because I could get all the people who were saying, this drinking is really affecting you, I could get them off my back. Not a lot of people understand that addiction is an illness, and one of its symptoms is it wants to hide behind any excuse that you can present in order for you not to closely look at that and confront it. So there's a lot of overlap between trauma, and there's a lot of overlap between self-medicating, and it actually makes it harder. But one of the biggest, most wicked problems with trauma, and this is why I always recommend therapy, if you can get it, or a mutual aid group where it's not about sitting in the problem, but about looking at the solution, is that there's a paradox where vulnerability is concerned. The more vulnerable a person becomes, the more unlikely people around them are to get around them and speak frankly to them about the action that needs to be taken to avoid a tragedy or avoid a further descent. And what this does is, ultimately, we become more vulnerable, we become less approachable for support, and so our vulnerability increases. How many people in here know someone who you almost dread contacting you because the level of adversity that they're in, much of it self-generated, is so severe that they've cut everyone off in their life who's tried to say anything that resembles the truth to them? Yeah, I see that you're struggling. Yeah, I see that you're traumatised. I see that you've been let down. But how does self-medicating with street drugs for your anxiety impact on that? You don't even know what's in the street drugs. How do you know that you have a clinical mental health problem if you've not been sober enough to get it looked at and diagnosed? These are the sort of things that we would say to a friend that we love. But someone becomes so vulnerable, you can't. And sadly, some of us have to withdraw from those relationships. There comes a point where the toll on us is too heavy. And actually, we can become easily manipulated in situations like that, because someone can be a victim. Someone can be traumatized. But when they're operating from self, protecting self, preserving self, getting their needs met. It also can potentially make you a very selfish person. And I say that from my own direct experience. You can be wounded, you can need care and sympathy, but you can also end up becoming someone who's transmitting your trauma on everyone around you while thinking everyone's got it in for you. It's very, very difficult. But everyone has their own personal threshold of, you know, what they can deal with and what they can't deal with in terms of trying to support people. But I won't pretend it's not a wicked, wicked problem. Okay.
Question at the back. Yeah, I got one. I was really interested by what you said about sharing of trauma as an art form. I'm a survivor of complex trauma myself and had a lot of therapy and then became a spoken word artist. And my experience of that has been that sharing of trauma it's almost a currency within that field, and it worries me the impact that has on people who don't have access to therapy, and they're using it and they're getting stuck in that sharing and that finding of language which you spoke of. But my question is around I've also worked in comms for charities, and my question is around the motivation that charities have for using stories of lived experience, because it is a form of entertainment. And it can be clickbait, and I'm sure that isn't the main driver of it, but I'm just concerned about that aspect of it, the performative aspect of it.
Can you just raise your hand so I can see you in the audience, so I can like make eye contact? Right, next one. Thank you. I've experienced the spoken word poetry community, and like any kind of culture or art scene, what you'll notice is that there's on one hand, there's this reverence for trauma and this rush to validate the feelings and thoughts and assumptions of anyone who tells their story. But that also there is always a hierarchy of which trauma is worth being platformed and which trauma is not important, or which trauma is really just the weaponization of a trauma in order to attack another traumatized group. So really, there's a fundamental cynicism sometimes that's unconscious, but you can really get damaged in those communities because there's no protocols for safeguarding there. It's a wild, wild west. Everyone just acting on impulse. I like them. I don't like them. That's fake. Da 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 da. They got that slot. I never. Blah blah blah. And then it's all played out in this little game of trauma Olympics. And when someone just gets a harsh word into them and says, cut the crap, then they all claim they've been re-traumatised by the truth. So no, I'm not into that. In terms of charities, in terms of the ways that we raise the visibility level of certain plights, certain adversities, again, it's about safeguarding and duty of care. While someone might signal their desire to be part of a public relations campaign, do they know what the implications of being a public face of a particular issue might be? Has anyone that's prompting them to do this done it themselves? Do they understand that once you're publicly visible, anything that you say, you can't take it back, or you have to do a kind of lifelong repair job because the thing exists and will always exist? And also, do charities, and this is something I went into a lot of depth about in Poverty Safari, it's not really the third sector's fault. The third sector's been left to handle a lot of the stuff that the state traditionally would deal with. So it's a way of the state kind of outsourcing a lot of its original responsibilities. And what the third sector actually does is act as a kind of safety valve to stop people from falling further into crisis. But unfortunately, that involves speaking truth to power, which is a hard thing for the third sector to do because of the way that the third sector is funded and supported. So there's a kind of unholy alliance, you know, where politicians of certain stripes will come to the photo campaign and they'll be like, da-da-da-da, and then they go back to Parliament and they'll do the policy that creates the food banks. We're taking photos with the food bank, like, hey. There's a kind of cynicism about that. And often a lived experience person will be at the heart of a campaign for media, to make it easy for audiences to engage with a particular thing. But overwhelmingly, the experience that I find that a lot of people have with media is that they come away from it regretting that they took part in the thing. because the way that their experience has been framed, or even the way they've been depicted in terms of even just photography, feeds tropes and stereotypes about the sort of person that has that particular type of problem. You can only combat that by doing something more authentic, which requires visibility, which requires more lived experience. We just need to make sure that, one, we, the lived experience people, are being honest with ourselves about our fitness to engage in this kind of exhibitionism, which is ultimately what it is. And charities need to think more clearly about what would happen if this person actually regretted this and then done some harm to themselves after it. How would we move if that might be an outcome? How would we speak to them? How would we prepare them? How would we support them to tell their story, but tell it in a way which is not about focusing on the graphic details of abuse, but focusing on the issue at hand that we want to talk about, which is systemic poverty, food poverty, blah, blah, blah. It's a hard job, but I think it's within the realms for every organisation to just get round the table and start clarifying what the informal protocols are around involving people with lived experience, and also paying them might help if they're so valuable. Why not pay them?
What should we pay them? What are you getting paid?
Thank you. I think it might be worth talking about the church's role in some of this as well. We've got a tradition of witnessing, which involves people telling their conversion stories. A high-value story could well involve experience of addiction, prison, violence. Mm. I've seen that happen very early in people's faith journey, and they may not be done with all of that stuff. I'm wondering what your reflection is on that, whether you've had any experience of seeing that happen, and how we could be more responsible with those things.
My experience is kind of definitely related to that. I got sober in church halls and community centres, which is where predominantly a lot of 12-step mutual aid groups function, because those doors are open to us out with office hours, and we get rooms for very cheap rent or donation only, which means that we can run the meeting and not worry about whether there's going to be enough people there to get donations to keep it going. So I have a kind of different understanding of the role that churches play in a community than maybe the debate about religion at that kind of internet YouTube level seems to have, you know. And also just the role that churches play in being one of the few places where people could go where they're not expected to spend vast amounts of money just to be in the same room as each other and to sit down somewhere for a little while and contemplate life rather than just being on the conveyor belt of consumption all the time, or you're kind of corralled away, you know, to make space for the next consumer. Stories play a very important role in that context. In a 12-step meeting, one of the primary ways where we, the person who suspects they may be mentally and bodily different from the average temperate drinker, we can confidently diagnose ourselves as addicts once we've sat in a room with other addicts talking about their experiences. So that's where you see the real utility of lived experience. I go to a meeting, I have an addictive mind that's telling me, no, 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 your addiction's not your problem. Remember that time in 2007 when you controlled it for one night? Remember that time? That's what I'm up against, that head. So in order to offset that delusion and denial, I place myself in the light of the truth. Well, there's other people who got sober and I can trust what they're saying might be true, because I can see them with my own eyes and I see how they carry themselves and I see that they've been a long time clean and sober. And so without any scientific study or journal or officialdom, I can say that person's experience is a lot like mine and they did these things in this book and then they got better. So maybe I could give this a try. Maybe part of my problem is I think I'm better than these people because this is a church, when actually they've got a solution to the problem that's destroying my life, and maybe I need to be a bit humbler when I walk in the door here. Like, that's a big journey you go on in that kind of environment. And there are faith-based elements to it. But those are defined by the discretion you're afforded and the confidentiality you're afforded. those are closed conversations, and that's an important principle that's emphasised always at the end. They hold up a yellow card. Who you see here, what you hear here, let it stay here. Because it's understood that the problem that we have is one of the most misunderstood and stigmatised problems going. And we don't get special status in culture. No one cares about how we feel about how everyone talks about addicts. No one cares about all the times we get triggered walking out our door and our local authority have sold every wall to alcohol advertisers and gambling facilities. And we're just getting triggered all day long. Nobody gives a shit about that. We're just addicts. Who cares? So it's in those rooms we get well, but we get well because there are principles we follow and basic kind of trust that what we tell and how we speak is not then used out with that space. And I think that's important. We want people to open up. We want people to get honest. We see the value in telling stories. It's how humans have educated each other throughout the whole course of our development. But in a world where everyone's a publisher now because of what's in their phone, and everyone's a telecommunication, and everyone's a broadcaster, it fundamentally changes the goalposts. The impulse to share needs to be offset by the thought of what the consequences are when it's not done in an appropriate context. You're saying there's meetings here on site for anyone in recovery who fancies to be meeting?
8 o'clock in the studio every night.
Brilliant. There you go. All on hand, sorted. Every need met.
Hi, Rhea. Thank you so much. I just wanted to ask how much of the sort of the rise of solo shows usually exploring trauma, how much of that do you think can be accredited to a rise of individualism and at a time where people are ever more isolated away from communities, despite being the most connected ever, like you just mentioned on our phones, we're all publishers, we've all got connections to millions of people around the world, and yet at the same time, community centres are closing down, people don't feel like they have solid, stable places to turn to. How do we tackle that?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of touched on that a little bit earlier. I was talking about the impulse to self-directed therapy, partly because of the vacuum in which the trauma discussion's occurring, where there's not adequate public services to deal with people's questions about what's happened, the impact that it's had. But also, I'm currently kind of tracking the exhibitionist aspect of it, not with the explosion of interest in trauma, but way, way further back at the turn of the millennium, when you had the advent of reality television, you had the artists began to, I think of artists like 50 Cent, got shot 9 times. That was his big selling point. I got shot 9 times and survived. Kanye West had tried to get a lot of success. Then he was in a car crash. He got his jaw wired. He wrote a song about it. That was when his music became like catnip. And then Eminem, I mean, that was when I came of age. This was a guy literally talking about growing up in a trailer park and his mum being an alcoholic and really going into a lot of detail about things that he said happened. And his life got worse after he got famous for telling those stories. But what those people did was they modelled a way of expressing what had happened. But they also modelled a way of doing it where you don't think about the implications of doing it. So how many people in a famous person who's talked about their trauma, how many people in their family are wounded by that being disclosed publicly? I mean, I've got members of my family that weren't very happy with some of the stuff I talked about, and even some who disputed the truth of the stuff that I said, and that was very triggering. So we're kind of stuck at the telling the story part. We think that's what's going to bring the healing, but it all depends on what happens after the story's been told. You're just telling it on social media, good luck, you know, because people aren't kind. They aren't kind. You need to be in a room where we can feel each other. There's some things I've said today that if you read it on Twitter, you would be unhappy about it. But here you can feel and sense me. You know what my intentions are. So you offer me the grace. That's why we have to think about the impulse. And why do we want to share it? Do we really share it because we want other people to benefit from it? Do we really want to help people? I'm sure we do. But there's other stuff in there as well. I want to feel seen. I want to be important. I want to feel secure. Let me tell you, if you're telling your story publicly hoping for those things, you're in for a big surprise. And if you aren't healed, Your wounds will be ripped open and it will be very, very frightening and scary for you. And I'm going to write all about all of that in my next book.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you. I'm very interested in, there's a lot of people in this field and in this tent, I'm sure, who are in trying to affect public policy and trying to do charitable work. And one of the things that kind of the whole world of PR does is say, we must do storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we even end up in a place where laws are named after individuals, you know, somebody's law. How do you think, and you mentioned this thing of kind of generating a composite person who might have suffered a composite trauma and using that to move a debate forward, but how can we be careful to use people's stories in a world where actually if we don't have stories, things don't change because politicians and the public do not respond to data. They don't respond to information, dry information.
Yeah, and that's a really valid thing to raise and a real problem. And we must contextualise any discussion about how stories are deployed within culture or policy formation with the fact that we have to recognise that's a position that we've all been put in by the way that culture has developed through public relations, which is largely dictated by media. The way our politicians behave, the way that they speak, the way that infuriates us, even the ones that we kind of like, the way they talk like robots, the way they emphasise some things and don't emphasise others, it's because nothing passes their lips that's not been focus grouped within an inch of its life, because it has to be safe to go out into the public realm and be cut with all sorts of different cultural substances and framed in all sorts of specific contexts. And that's the environment where we're trying to get a message out. So we need something powerful and something with what PR people will call cut through. A personal story of someone's adversity and how they overcame that is important. But again, it's also about when we're platforming that story, how does that further the objective of what the desire for the change is? How do we know that the person we're platforming is experiencing something that a bunch of other people are experiencing? And I think that's where we can take greater care. Because sometimes we don't put the lived experience person up to say, here is all the aspects of their experience which are common among all people. And this taps into a deeper systemic issue where we have a big sample size of people who feel like this and have gone through this. What we do is we say, let's get the most heartbreaking story we can think of to get eyes on our campaign. And then we further those objectives. And you can see this slight change in emphasis there. I just did the Health Equals campaign, which is a UK-wide campaign to try and get the government to think about health in a broader way than just fixing the NHS. Our health problems that we go to the accident and emergency for, they've been gestating for years in advance due to poor quality air, low access to nutritious food, no space, wide open space to exercise, poor quality housing, precarious work, unstable income. But in order to launch that, I had to go down to London, stand by the Thames with cameras in my face, and start the whole thing by saying, I grew up in a community where you had to walk a mile to go to a cash machine. I grew up in a community where it was kind of weird to buy vegetables. I grew up in a community where the parks was all littered with broken glass. So I was very aware of how my lived experience was being deployed. I have experience of being lived experience. A lot of people don't. So they just don't know why they're telling their story. They just have a sense it must be interesting for other people. Just being collaborative and getting the story to a place where it serves everyone. And we understand why it's being deployed, why certain things are being emphasised the way that they are. Is that okay as an answer? Thanks, I'll make sure my wife is cool with that. Did you feel that I answered the questions? So it was great feedback she gave me then, wasn't it? So thank you, wife, if you're here. She's got lived experience of being married to me, if anyone wants to platform her.
Yeah, thanks very much. That brings us to the end of the session. So join me in thanking Darren for his time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And a round of applause for the two lovely signers on the stage as well.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.